How many of you are really sad that we're done with Isaiah? Okay, I love Isaiah, but even more I love Jeremiah, to be honest. Jeremiah is one of my favorite books to read and to cover, which surprises people. Let's get into the five W's, because the emphasis, who wrote the book of Jeremiah? Now, Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah. We don't know a whole lot about them. By the way, there's another Hilkiah that appears in the Bible that's not the one that's Jeremiah's father. There is a Hilkiah who was a high priest during the reign of Josiah. If you're, and this isn't something I would test you on, but in 2 Kings 22, verse 8, he's the one that's, when they were repairing the temple, they find the book of the law, which is amazing to think that it had been lost, and they bring it to the king and say, look what we found, and they open it up, it's like, oh man, we're in big trouble. So that's a Hilkiah who was a high priest. But Jeremiah's father's name was also Hilkiah, but we think a different Hilkiah. One of the reasons that matters is Jeremiah was from the priestly family. He was descended from Aaron. So he lived in a town called Anathoth, which it sounds like I've got a lisp when I say it, but Anathoth was one of the Levitical towns, which you, if you remember in Joshua, I believe, when they cast lots and divided the land, they also appointed certain towns to belong to the Levites. Well, Jeremiah was a Levite, and that was his hometown. I'm looking for when, we'll talk about where later. One thing we know about Jeremiah, he was chosen by God before he was even born. And we know that because in chapter 1, verse 5, God says, I formed you in the womb, and before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you to be a prophet. Boy, some of you feel like your parents have been pushing you towards a certain career. God's telling Jeremiah, look, this is it. And he was told this by God when he was relatively young. Some scholars think Jeremiah might have been put on the job by God himself as young as age 14. Some say that. Others say maybe 17 or 18. Yeah, he was of the priestly family, yeah. So we don't know how, if he took his turns. Yeah, the question was he a priest? Remember, let's use the mics. But I don't know that he spent time slaughtering animals because he was sent to by God to be a prophet earlier than he would have started that training. So think of it. Jeremiah, when he started his work, was much closer to your age than he was to my age. Which I think, you know, if God called me now and said, I want you to go take this message to the nation, my first reaction would be, me? Why don't you call Mr. Kubik or Mr. McNeely? I'm just a kid. Imagine, and if he called you, you'd be saying, what about Dr. Dunkel? You know, I'm just a kid. Get one of the older guys. So Jeremiah has that feeling. God says, no, you're going to go do it. But significantly, God also promised Jeremiah protection. And I don't want to say too much because we'll get into some of these things are revealed in the first chapter. But God promised him, you're going to suffer, you're going to be attacked, but I will protect you and keep you safe. Jeremiah, you know, some of the things we know about Jeremiah, we do so because he revealed more about himself than any other prophet. Jeremiah bears his soul, so to speak, in his writing, which I think is pretty cool. You know, and in some cases, he writes about his experience, and then he writes what looks like a dialogue with God, where he talks to God about where he thinks maybe God's not doing the right thing, or God, I'm suffering, I'm miserable. You know, and God will answer back. Austin?
Wasn't Jeremiah known as like the crying prophet?
Yes, actually, he's sometimes known as the weeping prophet. So we use a little more formal word. Two nicknames he has, the weeping prophet. Sometimes he's called the suffering prophet because he did a fair bit of both. And we know that because he wrote it himself. And that's one of the things I'd like to say. You know, he had a stressful job. I mean, he was in a bad situation. He had to go tell people their sins and they didn't like it. And sometimes they would lash out. But he also was a patriot. He loved his country and he had to watch it be destroyed. I mean, he was there as a witness when the Babylonian armies overran the nation and destroyed the temple. You know, so it wasn't, this is going to happen sometime in the future. It happened in his lifetime. And he wasn't, oh, good, give them what they deserve. He literally wept, and he writes that he did. And along with this, some of the things we know about him, chapter 16 tells us that God told him, you can't get married or have children in this place. I like to add the "in this place" because that's what it says, and I've got this little hopeful theory of what might have happened later. But he goes through these rough times, and he can't go home and talk to his wife about it over dinner. He's just on his own. And as I said, he wept, but I like to make the point he was not a weak man. You know, weeping can be a sign of caring a great deal. And we can see as we follow Jeremiah through decades of his work, and he doesn't always give us all the time markers, but we'll see him mature and grow in strength and faith. And so even though, yeah, he cried, he was upset, he was stressful, we'll see him stand tall when the time comes. Justin?
You said God says he can't get married in a certain place?
Yeah, in that place, meaning there in Jerusalem. So,
but you also said he has a wife, so it was just
no, I
like,
said he's not allowed to have a wife.
He's not allowed to have
not
a wife.
Not allowed to get
oh,
married.
He couldn't
have
go
children.
Home and cry to his wife.
Yeah, I said okay. I was saying okay. He couldn't do that. Sorry, so I'm glad you asked because I don't want to make a misunderstanding. You know, like I can go home and say, oh man, you can't believe what those students did today. Blah, blah, blah. You know, and Sue will say, shut up. You think you've got a heart? Let me tell you about the middle school students. Which she doesn't tell me to shut up. But it's nice to have that companion. I remember that when I was in grad school, a lot of my fellow grad students were already married, and I thought, man, it'd be nice to be married. Yeah, Justin?
So it wasn't like he could just, I don't know, go to somewhere else and get married?
Well, yeah, he was there, and it's not like he could just say, you know, I'm going to apply for a job working for Microsoft and move to Washington. You know, that's where he was. Now, the point is, we're going to see that towards the end of his life, he does go somewhere else. And I wonder, because the Bible leaves off when he's in Egypt, did he later, as an older man, have the chance then to get married? I'll bring this up again later, but there's no record of it. Okay. And I was starting to make the point, even though Jeremiah was a weeping, suffering prophet, he wasn't weak. Meek, sad, but not weak. And as he grows and matures, I think he's a good example of courage and faith and perseverance. I've got those all written in bold type in my notes. So, you know, and in other words, he's somewhat of a hero of mine because of the end of his story, even though he doesn't always seem that way. So when Jeremiah began his work during the reign of Josiah. Yes, Justin?
Sorry. You said he's an example of courage, and what were the other two things?
Faith and perseverance. And those are just my words, so like I said I'm sort of giving a personal take on Jeremiah there. So, and King Josiah was what we call the last good king in Judah. Had a fairly, well, relatively long reign compared to some. So he begins working, some say, in the 13th year of King Josiah, which some scholars say was about 627 BC. And remember, these are estimations. Now, so some people say he began his work in 627. Others say, no, he was born in 627 and began prophesying a little bit later. So we don't know for sure, but his preaching, as is written, lasts about 40 years. So that's why I'm saying we've got decades. So if he begins, say, he's 14 years old, we see him all the way up to my age now. But it's not like he writes what year everything is, you know. His work covers the reigns of the five last kings of Judah. Now, who was the king we last saw as we were studying Isaiah, the king of Judah? Okay, Hezekiah, and remember, Hezekiah was a pretty good king, trying to lead people back to worshiping God. So I want to consider before Jeremiah. Before Jeremiah is even born, there's King Hezekiah. Hezekiah has a son named Manasseh. Not the same as the Manasseh for whom the tribe is named, but it's the same name. Manasseh is the worst king ever. He's bad. He's evil. He leads the whole nation into idol worship and sacrificing their children and all kinds of nasty stuff. Although it seems at the very end, later in his life, he actually repented and sought the true God. That's mentioned in 2 Chronicles chapter 33. But he's not able to turn the nation back. So after Manasseh, there's a king Amon, A-M-O-N. He's a bad king. No wonder. He was raised, you know, his dad was a bad guy, and by the time Amon takes the throne, it doesn't matter if Manasseh repented. Amon is so bad he's going to be assassinated and replaced by his son when the son is only 8 years old. And that son is Josiah. Okay, so Josiah takes the throne as an 8 year old. He's influenced by the high priest, and that's going to lead him to seek God and want to learn about God's ways. So Jeremiah doesn't start preaching when Josiah is 8 years old, but when Josiah is an adult, Jeremiah is going to be called and start his ministry. And if you see the chart, rather than me write this on the board, it's worth noting Josiah will have three of his different sons at one time or another be king. And part of the reason is two of them would be made king and then taken away as slaves by a foreign king. The first one is Jehoahaz. Jehoahaz is not his firstborn, but a younger son, and he reigns 3 months only, and then the king of Egypt comes and takes him away, and he never comes back. So the king of Egypt says, "You're not king anymore. I'm taking you away. I'm going to appoint your brother as king." And that'll be Jehoiakim with an M. Because one thing that's annoying sometimes, parts of Jeremiah is not in chronological order. You'll read a chapter where it'll tell us, this is in the such and such year of this king. Then later, this is in the such and such year of this king. And it turns out, oh, chapter 34 happened 20 years earlier than chapter 36. And, you know, I don't know why it's like that. We've got one theory. So anyways, Jehoiakim stays on the throne for 11 years. He's selfish. He's not a good king. We'll read the story of him burning one of Jeremiah's scrolls. So Jeremiah has to deal with Jehoiakim quite a while. When Jehoiakim finally dies, his son becomes king. So Jehoiakim's son is Josiah's grandson. But he's only going to reign for 3 months, as his uncle before him had done, and he's taken away as captive to Babylon. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, "I'm taking you away. You're not king anymore. I'm going to make your uncle king." So the uncle is the last son of Josiah, and he'll reign for 11 years like his brother had. And that last king is Zedekiah. Zedekiah is a name that'll probably stick in your memory, because when we get to the end, when Jerusalem is going to be conquered, his name comes up over and over, and we remember first and last, and some of what's in between. And I'm just saying that happens to be by memory. Zedekiah will eventually also be conquered. You know, he's the one that Nebuchadnezzar will come, conquer the city. Zedekiah will try to escape and be caught, and they'll kill his sons in front of his eyes, and then they'll put out his eyes. So they'll make him see his sons killed and then jab out his eyes so that's the last thing he ever sees, which is horribly cruel. Poor Zedekiah, then he goes off and dies in prison. And Jeremiah is on the job during all of that. From sometime when this guy is king through all those three sons and one grandson, who some of them are king only for 3 months, a couple of them are king for 11 years. So that's a lot. That's why I gave you a little chart that hopefully lays it out. Jeremiah overlapped with some other prophets too. For one thing, Zephaniah and Habakkuk, depending on how you want to pronounce it, we'll talk about them next semester in Minor Prophets. They're on the job at the same time, but we don't have record of them like getting together and having lunch, so we don't know if they knew each other. Sometime toward the end of Jeremiah's ministry, Ezekiel is called, but Ezekiel's way over in Babylon. And then also Daniel is over in captivity. So Jeremiah is alive when Daniel's the young man who refuses to eat the king's delicacies, you know, and, you know, I don't think Jeremiah is still around when Daniel gets thrown in the lion's den. That's enough later that it doesn't, you know, I think it's just later. But we'll see, and I'll mention this when we cover Ezekiel. Ezekiel will be trying to encourage the captives, the early captives taken to Babylon before the nation is destroyed, while Jeremiah is encouraging and preaching to those people that are still there waiting to be destroyed. Of course, they don't know that's going to be the end result. Okay, that's the when. There's a lot to it. Where is a little easier. He's from Anathoth, which I knew it was in my notes somewhere. I mentioned, which is about 3 miles northeast of Jerusalem. Say, Jerusalem's here. Anathoth is so close on this map that it's right on top of Jerusalem practically. So it's a suburb of Jerusalem. It's as close to Jerusalem as like downtown Milford is to us now. So, you know, and with modern automobiles, we wouldn't even think of it as a separate town, but it was then. But now, early in his ministry, it seems that he traveled around a bit. In Jeremiah chapter 11, and verse 2, you hear the words of this covenant, speak to the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, say to them. So there's some indication that, especially earlier in his ministry, he traveled around the nation. But most of his work is in Jerusalem. So Jeremiah takes up residence in the capital city, and that's where he's at. But towards the end of the book, Jerusalem gets destroyed, and we'll follow that he's with a group of refugees that go here and go there and eventually go to Egypt. And interestingly, there's one tradition that's not in the Bible but passed on that says that he was killed in Tapanes, an Egyptian city. That's one tradition. But there are other traditions and legends that we think are more likely true that say he went on from Egypt taking along one or more of King Zedekiah's daughters and eventually took them all the way to the island of Ireland. And we'll talk more about that later. But the Bible doesn't tell us that part of Jeremiah's story. But it's come down to us through the years in various legends. Last time we see Jeremiah in the Bible, he's in a frontier town of Egypt, prophesying about the bad things that are going to happen to the Jews that went there. Okay, let's talk about why. Okay, back to Jeremiah chapter 1, we see some of his commission there. Jeremiah 1 verse 10, God is telling him, I've this day set you over nations and over kingdoms to root out and pull down, destroy and throw down, and to build and to plant. Okay, so his primary message was to Judah, but it's evident that much of his message is to the broader nation of Israel. And that matters because Israel was gone by that time. They had been taken captive by the Assyrian Empire more than 100 years earlier, which lends support that much of this might be dual prophecy. And I'm saying it in those terms, much of it might be, because there are some places where it's very clear that there's end time prophecy, but a larger part of it looks like it's just for his time. And I would say that it's more easy to pick out moral principles that would apply to our time than specific prophecies. Whereas you've been going through Daniel, you can see, okay, I saw this image and it means this, and you look to the end time. When Jeremiah is saying, there's an army coming from the north and they're going to wipe you out, it's easy to see that applies to his time, and we're not sure where and when and if it applies to our time. But there are some places we'll see that it's very clear. But we want to go to this. What I read in verse 10 is sometimes referred to as a twofold commission, or we could say a dual commission, a two-part commission, however you want to write it down. One, root out and pull down, or destroy and throw down. A lot of Jeremiah's work was to proclaim the destruction that's coming to Judah. Basically, you sinned, you're worshiping false gods, you're breaking God's law, he's going to let the Babylonians come and conquer you because of it. It's pretty straightforward. Except for the part where we say, well, how much of that applies to us? Because our nations today are committing the same kind of sins. Yes, Jacob? The root out and pull down. Like, think of if you've ever done some gardening and you go to pull up weeds, God uses that phrase like, okay, the Israelites, I'm going to pull you out like I pull out a weed. And I'm going to shake off the dirt so it doesn't keep growing. Naya? Judah. Proclaim destruction of Judah. And as I said, where it's dual, we could say to Israel in the end time. But that build and plant, okay, by the way, is from about, you know, Jeremiah was predicting this destruction all the way from that 627 or 626 until 585 BC when it happened. The Babylonians came and they fulfilled his prophecies. From 587 onward, we get into much of what's not written down, but had been prophesied. And The some of his prophecies about building and planting is that God is going to establish the nation of Israel again. We could say when? Well, we know when Christ returns. By the way, that's one question that bugged me in the test. How many times did I talk about the second Exodus in this class? After Christ returns, what will happen to the Israelites? He's going to bring them back to the promised land. I wished I'd seen that answer show up more often. Anyways, we see that here. Okay, the build and the plant can refer to that, but also to God reestablishing his people, reestablishing blessings sooner. And if we understand, you know, our received prophetic scenario says, hey, if we're the descendants of Israel, look at us. We're doing pretty good. We think God poured out the promises of Abraham on our peoples in full measure starting about the year 1800, when the British Empire rose to be the wealthiest, most powerful empire there had ever been, and the United States was quickly growing to be the richest, most powerful single nation. And again, if we get into that legend with Tia Tefi, supposedly the name of that daughter of Zedekiah, does it also refer to planting or replanting the dynasty of King David? But again, we'll get to that more later. Yeah, I've got one more point. There's a lot of value in the book of Jeremiah for demonstrating two things that go together. One is God's righteous nature. Okay, it shows God is righteous, God is good and just, and then the opposite, the rebellious nature of man. That's illustrated pretty clearly. So that could be part of the answer, why did he write the book? God wanted to lay that out. Okay, I don't have a whole lot for the answer to the what, the last W, but we can say Jeremiah is one of the longest books in the Bible. It's often considered to be sad and depressing. Which is funny, because two of my favorite books are Jeremiah and Ecclesiastes, and people say that about both of them. But I think you have to see beyond the initial part. I want to write a noun up here. It's sometimes described as one long Jeremiad. Are you familiar with the noun Jeremiad? Basically, it's a noun that was derived from looking at the book of Jeremiah. It's a message of doom and gloom. So if you know, I'm writing about the United States now, and I say, you know, say I'm a Democrat. I could say, oh, the conservative policies of President Trump and his cronies are going to lead our nation to destruction, and blah, blah, blah. That would be a Jeremiad. It's foretelling bad news. We could have a Jeremiad written about ABC. You know, because our instructors are young and untried, and they won't let the students learn well and all that, oh, the institution's doomed to destruction. You know, I don't think any of that's true, but so a Jeremiad is a generic term derived from Jeremiah's prophecies towards Judah. Okay, but I would add, it's not just that. That's why I'm saying I like the book, because there's also the message of God's redemption. I should have brought it. The great yet I is evident in this book. You know, and some of the places it said most clearly. You know, yes, I'm going to punish you, yet I will not dispense with you altogether. Although he never says the word dispense. I've got a list of four themes that appear in Jeremiah that recur. Okay, one theme that's very prevalent is the judgment of God. God's judgment for sin. You know, or you could say judgment slash punishment, however you want to word that. So that's a theme, and that's the thing you see the most of in the book of Jeremiah. Okay, number two, and we see this throughout, and I've commented on it, is the personal life of Jeremiah. Jeremiah writes sometimes about what's going on. He writes about how he feels about what's going on. So that's a recurring theme. Okay, number three, something that comes up not as often, but is very important when it does, is the need for a new covenant. And especially we see that in Jeremiah chapter 31, where God says, I will make a new covenant, and I'll write my law in your minds and in your hearts. So that's, it doesn't come up as often as the other things, but it's there and recurring. And then fourth, another thing that's recurring is addressing false prophets. So Jeremiah is the true prophet, and guess what? People don't like his message. But there are false prophets, and sometimes Jeremiah and the false prophets confront each other and have it out. And guess who's going to win the confrontation? Well, on his own, Jeremiah wouldn't do so well, but with God behind him, there's one point where This false prophet breaks a symbol that Jeremiah has and said, oh, that's not going to happen. God's going to send the armies of Babylon back. And Jeremiah says, that's great. That's wonderful. And as he's going home, God says, Jeremiah, no, go back and tell him he's lying and he's going to be dead before the year's out. And actually, the guy lasts about a month and a half before he drops over dead. So better to be a true prophet than a false prophet. Okay, you guys numb yet? Oh, I've got still under what? I hesitate to do this, but I've got a three-part outline, and it's not balanced. But it's worth, as we're doing this, one is there are prophecies of Judah and of the millennium. So prophecies of Judah include its punishment, but also the millennium. And the prophecies focused at Judah are chapters 1 through 45. So when I say it's not balanced, this is most of the book. So chapters 1 through 45, prophecies to Judah. So number 2, prophecies for foreign nations, nations that are not Judah, are in chapters 46 to 51. You might guess we'll skim over those much more quickly than some of the others. And if you remember how many chapters are in the book, you might realize number 3 is one chapter. The last chapter, 52, is what's called a historical appendix. And it reads almost the exact same as a chapter that's in 2 Kings. And I will add this, I said it before, Jeremiah is not all written in chronological order. There are some of the events that might be labeled, but it's not. It's like what happened furthest back to what happened most recently. So it jumps around, and you guys should be used to that since you've had me talking about Isaiah for a while. Okay, you guys rest your fingers a minute. I want to look at least at chapter 1, because actually you'll see that's where a lot of what we've covered is, you know, already is. Matter of fact, I'm not going to read verses 1 through 3. Much of the 5 W's are covered there. So we have that, okay, in the year of such and such, Jeremiah, son of so-and-so, and of course, at the end of verse 3, until the carrying away of Jerusalem captive. So he's there. Okay, verse 4, we get into God's calling, and it's amazing. The word of the Lord came to me, which is to Jeremiah, and so God's telling Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. God's saying, I planned this out. It implies perhaps God was arranging who married who because he wanted the right DNA to result in this baby. And this is speculative, but God had a plan here. You know, and before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations. Imagine that's dumped on you when you're a teenager. God says, I got a big job for you. You're a prophet to the nations. And what does Jeremiah say? I can't do that. I'm just a kid. He doesn't say it in those words, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a youth. I'm sure in the Hebrew that came out as, I can't do that, I'm just a kid. And what does God say? Don't you say I'm a kid, for you shall go to all who I send you. So we have this back and forth. By the way, is Jeremiah the only one who ever tried to resist God's calling? Who do you know of? Okay, Moses, we'll talk about that later. One other, Jonah. Jonah not only resisted, he ran the other way. We can find partial evidence for some others, but those are the big examples. So Jeremiah is not unique, and if it happened to me, I probably would have said the same thing, and probably so would many of us. But God will not accept excuses. Don't say I'm a youth, you will go. And whatever I command you, you shall speak. That knowing my mother, I can imagine the way God said, you will go to who I send you, and you will say what I tell you to. And Jeremiah's probably, okay. But he adds some encouragement. Verse 8, don't be afraid of their faces, for I'm with you to deliver you. So God's like, I'm going with you, Jeremiah. I got your back. So yeah, it's intimidating, but don't sweat it. I'm with you. You know, and that would have to be encouraging. Verse 9, then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth. And he said, behold, I've put my words in your mouth. I think in a sense, God does that with any prophet. It's not always said that way. But he does so specifically in Numbers chapter 23 with Balaam the prophet. We don't think of Balaam because he was a bad prophet, but it said he was a prophet. God put his words in his mouth. We could also relate this back to Isaiah chapter 6. Remember, Isaiah saw a scene of God's throne and God says, who am I going to send? Isaiah says, well, I'll go. And they touch his mouth with the coals. So in the big prophets, we see a description of how they got on the job. And it's kind of exciting. Okay, so he does this, and then we already read verse 10. I've set you this day over the nations and over the kingdoms. And not to rule them as a king, but as a prophet, you know, to root out and pull down, to destroy and throw down. And this seems to be repeating the same thing. That's an example of synthetic parallelism. I think I've been saying Dr. Urweiler would talk about that. Has he talked about it? Okay, so I didn't lie. That's good. But also to build and to plant. There's an antithetical parallelism. And I say that because it actually seems to be written in poetry type. We could say God initially planted the nation of Israel. And remember, God will plant is the word Jezreel. So Jezreel is the name of a valley, but we see it in prophecy because it means God sows or God plants. But it can be described because it could also, it's the type of sowing like broadcast where you take the seeds and you do this. So it could also be translated as God scatters. So Jezreel comes up, especially in the book of Hosea, where it's like it could be planting or it can be I'm scattering you to the winds. But it's saying God initially planted Israel, but now he's going to pluck them up. So that they took root, but it was a bad plant, so he's going to rip them up. And I had the question, when will he rebuild? When will he build and plant? Well, one answer is when God poured out the blessings of Abraham on the modern descendants of Israel. And we'll go over a scripture in Leviticus that shows that he might have determined a period of 2,520 years where we have a prophecy similar to the one you went over in Daniel of 7 years. And if a day for a year, day for a year applies, it comes out to that. But either way, we also know when Christ returns, Israel is going to be brought back. That second Exodus. I'll say it again and again because it's in the Bible again and again. Although not with that name, but I will bring you back and I'll plant you in your land. So we could debate whether it's happened in initial time, but when Christ returns, he will build and plant Israel and Judah. Okay, so verse 11, moreover, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Jeremiah, oh, we're getting to visions already. I just gave you your job. What do you see? A branch of an almond tree. It's interesting because when we get to Ezekiel, he's going to see wheels within wheels and these weird creatures. Jeremiah, what do you see? Well, branch of an almond tree. Well, let me tell you what that means. The Lord said, you've seen well, for I'm ready to perform my word. Okay, an almond tree in that place was often considered a harbinger of spring. The almond trees bloomed early. So God is showing you, this is like being a prophet 101. It's the introduction. You see this, the almond trees bloom early. It symbolizes that I'm going to do this pretty soon. This isn't a prophecy for 400 years from now. It's coming soon. And then we go on. He sees another one. Second time, verse 13. What do you see? A boiling pot. And it's facing away to the north. So the Lord gives the interpretation. Out of the north, calamity will break forth on all the inhabitants of the land. And he goes on. So he sees a boiling pot from the north. So if it's from the north, it's toward the south. Okay, the Babylonians are here, but they're following that fertile crescent up and around and then down from the north to the south. So it's not a great mystery, but he's saying that's where it's coming. Where is it not coming from? No threat from Egypt. Egypt is not going to come and conquer you. The Arabs aren't going to come and conquer you. It's coming from up here. So God's just laying it out. That's the way it's going to be. And other families will be involved. Verse 15, I'm calling all the families of the kingdoms of the north. They'll come and each one set his throne at the entrance of the gates of Jerusalem. So we see this destruction coming. And we already seen that it's going to be pretty soon. So let's jump ahead to verse 17. Therefore, so Jeremiah, knowing what you've just seen and what it means, prepare yourself and arise and speak to them all that I command you. It's funny, I had a note here. Nobody probably is reading the old King James in front of you, or the old King James, it literally says, gird up your loins and go speak. So I was talking about what gird up your loins means in the other class. And here in the new King James, they translate it as prepare, which is what it means. So go out and proclaim this message. Tell the people what is going to happen. And in a sense, I made a note to connect this to Mark 16 and verse 15. Near the end of the book of Mark, what did Jesus tell his disciples? One of the last times he saw them, maybe the last time, what were they supposed to do? We sing a song based on it. Go ye therefore into all the world, preach the gospel. So we've got a commission that parallels Jeremiah's. We know certain things and we're told to go share it. Jeremiah's will go out there and preach the word. And don't be dismayed before their faces. And here's a little irony. Don't be dismayed by them, lest I dismay you. You know, when you're a parent, well, maybe as a kid, you've heard your parents tell you something like that. Dad, I can't do that. They'll make fun of me. Now, I'm going to make fun of you if you don't get out there and do that. By make fun of, it means I'm going to set your rear end on fire. So again, I'm reminding us, God promises hardship. But he also promises protection. Moving on in verse 18. Behold, I've made you this day a fortified city. Now, this is symbolic poetry. Jeremiah, you're a fortified city. You're a bronze wall against the whole land, against kings of Judah, against his princes, against his priests, against all the people of the land. They will fight against you. So guess what? The king is against you, Jeremiah. That's kind of scary. How'd you like it if I told you President Trump is out to get you? Well, he's got a bit of power at his disposal. And not only that, but the princes. So him in his cabinet and the priests, so all the religious leaders. Man, Jeremiah is like, oh, they're all against me. But God promises something else. Verse 19, they will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you. I'll take having all those guys against me if God is saying they're not going to prevail. I'm going to make you like a bronze wall. And he says, for I am with you, says the Lord, to deliver you. That means a lot. That doesn't mean, you know, suffering and destruction and hurting won't come. We're going to see Jeremiah dropped in a dungeon where he sinks down in the mud and he's all alone in the dark. Jeremiah was probably thinking, God, I thought you were going to protect me. And somebody came and pulls him. Somebody comes and pulls him out. God does keep his promises. So that's pretty powerful. I'll mention here, and I'll remind you it's on the test coming up, there are two other people that in the book of Jeremiah that God promises this kind of protection. One is his scribe, Baruch. We're going to meet Baruch quite a bit later. I think of Baruch as Robin to Jeremiah as Batman. And the other one is a guy that we barely meet, but God promises him personal protection, and that's Ebed-Melech. Ebed-Melech. God promises these three men, I'll protect you. Your life will be a prey to you or a prize. Meaning they're going to fight against you, they'll try to hurt you, but I got you. I'm going to protect you, they will not kill you. Don't you wish you had that promise? Yes, Justin?
Who is Ebed-Melech?
He's a guy, he'll show up in the story later, but God promises him bodily protection.
Is he just a random guy?
Well, he's the guy that pulls Jeremiah out of the dungeon. I forgot, I just mentioned that he's in the dungeon. Ebed-Melech goes and gets him out, and God, as a reward, says, I'm going to protect you. Considering an army is about to destroy the city, that's a promise of protection that's worth quite a bit. Okay, so we did get through a chapter, so next time we'll pick up with chapter 2. And I warn you, we're going to gird up our loins and run through parts of Jeremiah. I'm glad somebody chuckled at that. Okay, so have a good night.